It is a joy to be here tonight. Thank you so much for the invitation. As has been mentioned, I think this is time number four, so y'all must like being persecuted. I am going to be teaching you tonight as if this were my class in a college setting, because what I'm going to talk to you about is more like a lecture than a sermon. So, and I just want to warn you ahead, I'm going to call you my class, because that's what I look upon this particular effort as. Thank you for the privilege of being here, and especially for being able to speak on behalf of the God of heaven by looking together with you at the evidences of the natural world. That's what this series is about. So I want to lay a few ground rules for you. First of all, I hope you can be here every lesson. There are five lessons we're going to do together that relate to the scientific evidence for the existence of God. Tonight's lesson number one. We'll not touch the hem of the garment tonight of what should be said. By the time we finish five lessons, we will at least touch the hem of the garment. And I hope you can come back and be with us for all of those. Secondly, in my class, I don't allow sleeping. And I can see you. And I've been teaching for a long time. So I'm just letting you know ahead of time, if you start to nod off, I can see you. And if there's enough of you doing that, we'll take a brief pause and everybody will stand up. And you will shake yourself and get yourself awake. Because I don't want you to miss any of the key points to what we're going to talk about. And thirdly, this is a science lesson class. I will make reference to the Bible because we're talking about Christianity and science. Can they be confronting each other, or do they cohere? I think you know my position. They are coherent, but our world today doesn't say that. So I'm hoping by the end of these five lectures, I will have helped you see there's a perfectly reasonable basis for being a believer in God, looking only at the natural world and its evidences. So those are the ground rules. Thank you for being here. Some of you have come a long way, and I just thank you so much for your interest. And now let's get right at the subject at hand, because we have much to talk about tonight and throughout the week. So, IT guys, are you ready? Good. By the way, I meant to say, we count on IT guys. So, you need to give them hugs afterwards tonight. Even if they mess up. Because we absolutely depend on them. And especially for a series like this. So, you ready? There's our topic for this evening. Christianity and science. Do we find conflict or coherence? Well, if you look up here, you'll see there's a book entitled exactly that. Science and Christianity, Conflict or Coherence by Henry Schaeffer. Anybody in this room ever heard of Henry Schaeffer? Raise your hand. Okay, not very many. I think we saw one. Henry Schaeffer is one of the foremost chemists of our time. Very widely respected gentleman. And a strong believer in God. And the purpose of this text written by him was to show his students that there's a reason to believe in God, even if you're a scientist. And there are many scientists that would disagree with that. So, I'm going to be using his text somewhat, and I sure recommend it to you if you want some reading. And by the way, as you take your notes, class, that was a hint. I'm going to provide you names of a lot of books, but I'm going to provide the bibliography so you have that and you don't have to copy all the books down. And well, they'll have all these books and a bunch more in them, and the best ones with stars by them. So, Henry Schaeffer's book on conflict or coherence we'll be referencing throughout the evening. And so what I would like to do first now is talk to you about what Christianity says about this. And of course, to do that, we need to look at the Bible. So I hope you brought your Bible, and we're going to turn to Psalm 19, first of all. And I offer my apologies this evening for not spending more time on the biblical text, but that's not the primary purpose of my subject. Psalm 19 says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There's no speech nor language. Their voice is not heard. Their line has gone throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." The Old Testament, which is the fundamental book on which Christianity is founded, teaches that the heavens declare that there's a God, and that you can learn about that by observing them. That's in the Old Testament. So let's turn next to the New Testament, Romans chapter 1 and verse 20. And if we were teaching this class from the perspective of the text of the Bible, these would be two of the key passages. Romans 1 verse 20 says, "For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they were without excuse." Now, eyes on the screen, and let's summarize what that just said. His eternal power and his divine nature can be observed by observing nature. That's what this passage teaches. In fact, he says they're without excuse. So there's enough evidence in the natural world to convince one reasonably that there is a God. And how is that? It's the famous and most important argument for the existence of God from the natural world. This passage says when you look at things that are designed, it makes you conclude there's a designer. That's the argument. And I'm convinced that's the strongest argument for the existence of God from the natural world. Well, the Bible says that, folks. So does Christianity teach that you can learn about God from the natural world? Yes, it does. I've just given you the two passages. Now, please don't take any offense. But for the rest of my time this evening, I'm not going to be using this book. I'm going to be using God's other book, because I'm convinced God has given grand testimony of himself in the book of nature. And it is to that we will turn next. And I will tell you that many of the scientists who helped develop the modern day scientific method were strong believers in God, and in the Bible, and in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. Again, we're going to just kind of lightly trip over this, but I want you to know that there are multiple instances of people in the ancient ages. We mentioned this slide, 1600 to 1800, the period of the Renaissance, as the modern world of science was unfolding. During that time, the greatest names in science were strong believers in God. Let me give you some examples. Here's a famous one, Johannes Kepler, 1571 to 1630. Johannes Kepler was a famous astronomer, and here are some of the things he said about his work. "I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. Since we astronomers are the priests of the highest God in regard to the book of nature, it benefits us to be thoughtful, not of the glory of our minds, but rather, above all else, of the glory of God." Don't you love that? Here's a man who was widely respected for his incredible ability to observe the heavens and come up with grand conclusions. This man was given credit for explaining and finding the laws of planetary motion in our solar system. He's given credit for the three laws of planetary motion. And I'll not quote those to you, but every one of them is fascinating. But he uncovered that by observing the natural world. And he didn't have all the benefits that you and I do. But his whole position was, we're the priest of the Most High God as we examine the natural world. Here's another statement. "Studies of the world using science are acceptable to me and to Christians, since our faith holds that the world was created by God in weight, measure, and number, that is in accordance with ideas co-eternal with him." Here's a man who was
deeply respected for his deep knowledge of the science of his day, who also had great respect for God. And he also said, by the way, I believe only and above all in the service of Jesus Christ. In him is all refuge and solace. Direct quote from Johann Kepler. I love that. I'm sorry to tell you that many scientists today are proclaiming their amazement at their own minds, not God's mind. And that's a sad change over time. Well, how about this one? If you didn't know Johann Kepler, you certainly know Isaac Newton. Many say he was the greatest mind that's ever been, and certainly the greatest scientific mind. Well, here's one famous quote from Isaac Newton, who discovered, by the way, the law of gravity, and is given credit for developing the calculus. Dan, where are you sitting? There you are. He was in my calculus class. Pretty good student. But one of the things I always teach in the calculus is this. When you're studying infinity and we're able to describe it mathematically, there's no time you'll ever be closer to thinking God's thoughts after him, because you're examining infinity. And by the way, Dan, if I were to drill you tonight, could you tell them how you determined if there is a limit? You don't have to answer. The limit concept is the foundation for all of calculus. And what it says is there are certain situations where there's a limit even when you approach infinity. If you approach infinity, you never get there, right? But there are instances where you can get an answer when you're approaching infinity. There's no time you'll get closer to thinking God's thoughts after him. And that's the way we ought to be thinking all the time. So here's one quote from Newton, the inventor of the calculus. Though these bodies, and he's referring to the solar system, may indeed continue in their orbits by the mere laws of gravity, and may I pause there just a moment and tell you, he's the one that discovered the law of gravity and described it mathematically. Nobody had ever done that before. And so you know probably, science students, that when you have two objects of mass, there's a force between them called gravity that's inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them and directly proportional to their masses. Have I lost you? That's a mathematical expression for the relationship between objects with mass and gravity. And you don't know this, but during the days that Newton was proposing this, it was considered weird and strange that two objects with mass could somehow affect one another and they're not even touching each other. That's weird. But he described it mathematically and then developed the gravitational constant that relates the two. Incredible. Now let me finish. These orbits could be, by the mere laws of gravity, continue, but they could by no means have at first derived the regular position of orbits themselves from these laws. Thus, this most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being whom he called God. So here's one of the greatest thinkers of all time, saying that the solar system declares the glory of God, just like the psalmist said. And may I say to you, that was the case for the majority of scientists in those early days of the development of science. So, in the early 1800s, young people in this audience who are at college age or close to that, had you gone to college in England, in those days, in the early 1800s, every student in college took a class like this called natural theology. And this was the most famous text of that day. It's by William Paley. And it starts with this famous story about the watchmaker argument. So what I'd like to do is read you that text verbatim. And I'm going to put a little bit of a British accent with it, because it just seems like it ought to be. In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that for anything I knew to the contrary.
inquired how the watch happened to be in that place, I should hardly think the answer given before would be sufficient. The watch must have had a maker who comprehended its construction and design, who used every manifestation of design which existed in the watch. It exists also, ladies and gentlemen, in the works of nature, with the difference being on the side of nature, being greater and in a degree that exceeds all computation. Then I lose you. His argument is, if you think the watch was designed, look at nature. It has much more design than the watch ever dreamed of. So the famous watchmaker argument in his book on natural theology, can you read the subtitle up here? Evidences of the existence and attributes of the deity collected from the appearances of nature. And so the rest of the book was showing you the amazing things in nature that testify to design. Charles Darwin took this class. And maybe you don't know, but Charles Darwin studied to be a preacher first. And he was deeply impacted by Paley's book on natural theology. But when he took his trip around the world on the ship, you remember that took about 3 years, his mind began to change as he observed nature, and he thought he had come up with something that nobody had ever thought of before to explain the natural things in the world without God. So his mind began to change. But this was standard in the early 1800s. So how is it, ladies and gentlemen, that by the end of the 20th century, we had people who were in the scientific community like Richard Dawkins, who's still alive today? He is the British evolutionary biologist and author, professor of public understanding of science at Oxford. I only tell you all of that to tell you that Richard Dawkins has become a spokesman for the new atheists. And he has also been appointed by his college, Oxford, to represent to the world what science has learned and to help you understand it. And he's as wrong as he can be about a whole lot of things. Here's one of the things he said in his book, The Selfish Gene, 1976. Faith is blind trust in the absence of evidence, even in the teeth of evidence. It is a process of non-thinking. That's not very nice. Because I have faith in God, so what he's saying about me is I'm a non-thinker. And that I believe what I believe in the face of the evidence, not because of the evidence. Well, where does that come from? It comes from a complete misunderstanding of what true faith is. Because faith, as described in the Bible, is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. It's founded on evidence, ladies and gentlemen, but not according to Richard Dawkins. And then in his book, The God Delusion, it gets worse, 2006. If this book works as I intend, he says, religious readers who open it will be atheists when they put it down. You see, what's happened is modern-day atheists have become evangelistic. They not only believe there's no God, but they want to convince you there's no God. And so they preach it loud and clear. And so listen, I meant to say this at the beginning too. If I get loud and feisty in this series of lectures, I'm not asking your forgiveness, because there's plenty of that going on the other side, and you don't get to hear this side very much. And we need a little bit of force behind it, because the evidence is overwhelming if you see it clearly. And then he says, God is a delusion, a psychotic delinquent invented by mad, deluded people. Mr. Dawkins is not very nice. Now, not all scientists are that way, but he's supposed to be a spokesman for the scientific community. He's divisive and pretty ugly in what he says sometimes. And that's unfortunate. I want to try not to do the same. I want to be understanding, helpful, and thoughtful, and kind, but firm. So I'm asking you, class,
If you see me saying something that is ugly and mean, I wish you'd correct me. But just because you're firm doesn't mean you're ugly and mean. I don't like what Mr. Dawkins said up here. But the whole book, The God Delusion, is about how you believers in God are a bunch of deluded people following a psychotic God. I say, God forbid. And then there's Carl Sagan, series in 1980, the most popular science series ever been on television. And here's the original statement from that series. The cosmos is all that is, or was, or ever will be. Now I'm pausing there. And when I pause, ladies and gentlemen, I want something to sink in. That, ladies and gentlemen, is not a scientific statement. That is a statement of philosophy. He believes it with all his heart. But it's not a scientific statement. Science cannot demonstrate to you that the cosmos is all there is, or ever was, or ever will be. Science can't tell you that. That's a conclusion he's drawn based on his understanding of the evidences. But it is not in itself a scientific statement, but the whole science series was founded on that. And listen, scientific materialism has taken over our colleges. So how did things change so radically in 200 years? So I'm going to give you the quickest history of science in the history of mankind. I'm just going to run through this real quick, and then I'm going to give you a bibliography you can read as deeply as you want. Pierre Simon de Laplace lived in the 1700s and early 1800s, looked upon himself as Isaac Newton II, and may I say he was far from it. But de Laplace took the same evidence that Newton looked at and said this: nature with its matter, energy, and forces could produce and maintain our solar system. No need for a God hypothesis. We don't need God to explain the solar system, said Laplace. And that notion caught on. Charles Lyell, in his book, The Principles of Geology in the Early 1800s, was an attempt to explain former changes in the Earth's surface by reference to causes now in operation. The present is the key to the past, said Charles Lyell. And so he would say to you, all the formations you see, the geological formations, can be explained by small changes over long periods of time, same things that are happening right now, and you don't need God. So you don't need God for geology. And then Charles Darwin came along in 1859 with his most famous work, and might I say, probably the book that has had the greatest impact on the educational world, other than the Bible, is this one. Have you ever read the subtitle of this book? The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Did you hear that? And might I say that Hitler used that notion in World War II to say there is a race that is favored. It happens to be my race, he said. The Aryan race was the most important race. And other races like the Jewish people and a whole lot of other folks that he didn't like don't deserve to live because they are not the favored races. And so he killed them by the millions. That notion founded firmly on the idea of Charles Darwin in The Origin of the Species, who said, there's no need for a designer to account for the origin of species of life. Natural selection acting on natural variation accounts for the appearance of design. It looks like it's a design, but it isn't. Natural selection acted on natural variation produces all the things that look like they were designed. So you don't need God there either. 1859, class, and it has swept the world in the last 150 years. Then Alexander O'Perrin and John B.S. Haldane came up with the notion that you don't need God to produce life from non-living matter either. And I'm not taking the time tonight to explain their theory. The Haldane-O'Perrin hypothesis was the beginning of this world in which we live was different than it is now and could have produced life from non-life even though it can't now. And therefore you don't need God for that either. So you don't need God for the solar system, which has become the universe. You don't need God for geology. You don't need God for living things. And you don't need God to produce non-living things to make living things. So you see, over 150 to 200 years, the whole notion of God has been eliminated in the minds of an awful lot of folks. I say, class, it's time to revisit the argument from design. And that's this series of lectures, that's what it's about. And I would say to you, I want you to be excited because it's as if in the last 100 years, God has opened the floodgates of natural evidence to demonstrate there had to be God behind this. And I'm hoping to get that across to you. And I'm going to start with Stephen Meyer's trilogy. I really appreciate the writings of Stephen Meyer. He's also a strong believer in God. And he's written 3 great books I'd surely recommend to you. They're about this thick, so it's a lot of reading, and some of it pretty heavy. But the signature in the cell is about DNA and the amazing things we've learned about that. That's my lecture tomorrow night. Don't miss it. Darwin's doubt is about the earliest layer of fossils. It's called the Cambrian layer. It was a great trouble to Darwin. How did you get all these different life forms in that one layer with nothing leading up to it? It's a problem. And of course, that subject then is for the origin of life. How did life get started? Class, you got to explain how you got living things from non-living things. Nobody believes there have always been living things. So at some point in history, living things came into existence. How did that happen? That's the book Darwin's Doubt. I don't know what I'm doing here.
One second, I got it.
Can I stop it?
You're good.
Am I good? What did I do?
I saw you.
There's ghosts. All right, his third book's the one I want to reference tonight. It's called The Return of the God Hypothesis. And it's based on Laplace's original statement, we don't need the God hypothesis anymore, in the early 1700s. Stephen Meyer says, what we've learned in the last 75 years in science is pointing once again that we need the God hypothesis. And so here's what he summarized in this book. There have been 3 great scientific discoveries in the last 100 years that have overturned and revived the argument from design. One is the universe, space, matter, and time had a beginning. I'm not going to talk about that one in this series of lessons, but I've given you books about it. It is highly agreed upon in the scientific community now that this universe had a start. It's called the Big Bang. And I'm not here to talk about that. There's some serious problems with that. But they believe that's how it started, and so it had a beginning. If it had a beginning, who began it? And how did it get started? It is a major problem, and I will tell you that generally evolutionists do not like the idea that there was a beginning. The common theory 100 years ago was that nature's eternal. That matter and time and space have always existed. And so you didn't have to worry about a beginning. Well, the science doesn't support that anymore. So that's number one. Number two is, everywhere you look, the universe looks like it's fine-tuned to support life here on Earth. And it has been since the beginning. How do you account for that? Fine-tuned. I am going to talk about that one tonight. And I hope if you don't remember anything else tonight, you'll walk out of here knowing at least how to make the fundamental argument about fine-tuning. And then thirdly, even the simplest forms of life at the biochemical level contain massive amounts of digital information being used to produce and maintain an untold number of molecular machines and complex processes. In short, everywhere you look, there's a massive amount of information being used to do amazing things at the cellular level. And I'm going to talk about that briefly tonight and then much more through the week. Those three things, Meyer argues, are enough to take us back to the design argument. So let's talk about fine-tuning a little bit. Here's a book by an atheist by the name of Paul Davies. His book is entitled The Goldilocks Enigma. Now, I almost wish I could call on some of the kids in this class, like this little boy over here. Have you taught him Goldilocks? Probably. No? Well, all of you know Goldilocks, don't you? She went out into the woods and came to the home of the three bears. And when she went inside, she went to the table, and there were three bowls. You remember? She tried the first one, and it was too hot. That was Papa Bear. Then she went to Mama Bear, and she tried it, and it was too cold. And then she went to Baby Bear's bowl, and it was just right. What I'm trying to argue in this particular part of my lecture tonight is there are lots of things that had to be just right and then continue to have to be just right, or you wouldn't be here. And if this were a court of law class, the defense and the prosecuting attorneys would be saying the same thing about this. People don't disagree on the facts about this. They don't. Don't believe me. You look for yourself. Paul Davies is an evolutionist. And here's what he says in his book, The Goldilocks Enigma. An enigma is a puzzle. He's having a hard time figuring this out. One of the most significant facts, arguably the most significant fact about the universe, is that we are part of it. How did we get here? Everyone agrees that the universe looks as if it was designed for life. That's not a preacher talking. That's an evolutionist. It's like Goldilocks. Things are just right. So class, in your mind, I want you to envision a machine, humongous machine. Let's just say it has 500 knobs on it. And in order to produce and maintain life, every one of those knobs has to be turned to an exact setting. And if you move any one of them a little teensy bit, you don't get life. Are you with me on that picture? Now I want to talk about a few of those knobs. There is no such machine, but I'm just telling you it's a good illustration. So here we go. The anthropic principle is the principle that we anthropos are here because things sure look like they were designed. When I was in school in the 1960s, my kids say that was before the flood. It was not before the flood. And by the way, Carl Sagan was teaching at Harvard when I was a student there. So were a bunch of these other guys I'm quoting from. And they were as messed up then as they are now. They had discovered two characteristics of the cosmos that was fine-tuned to make physical life here possible. Two. They discovered 8 to 10 of our solar system that were fine-tuned for human life in the 1960s. No wonder, class, I was being taught then by my science professors that you folks who believe in God and the Bible better get over it. Because all you're doing is sticking God in the gaps of your knowledge, and the more we learn, the less you need God. And the time is coming when we're going to get all this figured out very shortly. And you believers are going to be embarrassed. That's what I was being told. Well, let me tell you what's happened. By the 2000s, scientists discovered 38 characteristics of the cosmos and over 150 characteristics of the solar system that were all fine-tuned to support life. Even in new math, that's 188. Different factors. So you remember that dial I was talking about? 188 dials, all set perfectly, or you wouldn't have life. Now I want to get at this a different way. This is one of my favorite books. It's called God's Crime Scene, written by J. Warner Wallace. J. Warner Wallace is a cold case detective. You know what that is? That's a detective that'll take a case that has not been solved for years, and he solves it. That's what this man does for a living. He was raised by a daddy who was an atheist, and he was also a detective. He wrote this book because J. Warner Wallace has become a believer in God, and he wanted to convince his daddy. And so one way he's approached it is, he treats God's universe as a crime scene. And he applies the methods of a detective to figure out what's the best solution to how this came to be. Every chapter is built on a case that he solved. So, class, are you awake? You look pretty good. I'm proud of you so far. This is chapter 2. The title of the chapter is Tampering with the Evidence. So we're having a little reading session here. All of your eyes should be right up here. I'm looking at you. Helen knew something was wrong when her daughter Carrie failed to answer the door. It was a bright summer afternoon. Carrie said she'd be home, and her car was indeed parked in the driveway. Helen tried to peek in through the living room window, but the curtains were unusually drawn. Carrie never locked the back door, but when Helen walked into the backyard of the old house, she found the door locked and all the windows closed. This was not like Carrie. She usually left at least one badly worn rear window slightly ajar. Helen began to panic. She knew Todd and Carrie had a tumultuous marriage, one that included physical violence. Todd had moved out, but Helen still feared for her daughter's safety. The couple had a child named Lexi, but the violence had only intensified since her birth. In fact, a week ago, Todd had threatened to kill Carrie, and just last night, Carrie confided to her mother there had been another fight. When Helen couldn't get Carrie to answer the door this afternoon, she decided to call the police. And they came over and began to investigate. Now, I'm not going to read all this to you, but he starts laying out what they found out. So I'm going to tell you a few things. And by the way, I'm going to tell you the end from the beginning. Todd was convicted of first-degree murder, and nobody saw the murder. There was no direct evidence. It was a compilation of circumstantial evidence that all piled up. Did you know you can convict somebody of first-degree murder on that kind of evidence? You can. So here's some of the evidence. First of all, when they finally got in the house, it smelled like gas. So they had to get out, bring in the hazmat guys, and get it all ready and fixed up. And finally, when they got upstairs in the bedroom, they found two dead bodies, Carrie and Lexi. And it sure looked like they'd been asphyxiated by gas. The officer responding had found the door to the master bedroom closed and a pile of laundry lay up against the bottom of the door. Carrie didn't leave clothes lying around. You see, here's the question, class. There were two dead bodies. How'd they get there? Was it some normal process could be explained by staying inside the house? Or did somebody tamper with this? You see what I'm saying? That's how the detective went about it. Well, folks, the door being closed and all the clothes piled up against it, that's pretty damning evidence. They retrofitted a gas heater that was mounted to the wall separating the bedroom from the upstairs hallway. The pilot light was out, but the gas bulb was open, full. As a part of the follow-up investigation, they discovered that the gas company had turned off the gas service for lack of payment. But 2 days before this death, Todd had paid for the service to be started again. They opened up a crime investigation instantly. There's enough circumstantial evidence. Folks, when you look at the foundational evidence, there was a troubled marriage, threats of living, killing somebody, and then a whole line of evidence piled up. Somebody tampered with this. That's the case he presents here. And I've already told you, they convicted Todd of first-degree murder. So here's what he says. Like our murder scene, there are foundational, regional, and locational conditions demanding an explanation. You see, they needed to explain why there were two dead bodies in that house. We need to explain why there are millions of living bodies on this earth. And there are lines of evidence that all point to this. The foundational laws of physics, the regional properties of our solar system, and the locational conditions of our planet resulted in our existence. But did this have to be the case? If circumstances had been just slightly different in Carrie's house, she wouldn't be dead. If conditions were just slightly different in our universe, you wouldn't be here. Are you listening? And everybody knows it. There is a powerful pile of evidence that says everything's fine-tuned to keep us alive. How'd that happen? That's a good question. And this is a good book. So let's examine it a little bit. I'm going to give you a couple of illustrations. You see, in our universe, there are physical constants and ratios, properties of elements, that all add up to some amazing evidence. The force of gravity must exist within narrow ranges in order for life to exist in this universe. I told you Newton discovered the laws of gravity. What we now know is that gravitational constant has to be tuned in, folks, in down to the 1/10 billionth. You change that one little bit, you wouldn't be. If the value of the ratio between electrons to protons varied by more than 1/10^37, the universe as we know it would not exist. So 1/10^37, I just lost you. You don't have a clue how big that is. So, J. Warner Wallace gives you an illustration. So you ready, class, for the illustration? How tiny a change would have to be of the ratio of electrons to protons for you not to be? Imagine covering the entire North American continent in dimes and stacking them until they reach the moon. You got it? The North American continent stacked with dimes until it reaches the moon. Now imagine stacking just as many dimes again on another 1 billion continents of the same size as North America. If you mark one of those dimes and hit it in the billions of piles you've assembled, the odds of a blindfolded friend picking out the correct dime is approximately 1/10^37. The same level of precision required for the ratio of protons to electrons. You see it here on the screen? Laws of nature, physical constants, properties of elements, properties of chemicals, every one of those got dozens of examples just like that. You turn that knob 1/10^37, no, that's way too much. You wouldn't be. Don't believe me. You go look it up. I'm telling you the truth. The foundational fine-tuning for this universe is incredible, and if it weren't that way, you wouldn't be. Let's talk about regional factors. That's like closer to the house. Like the galaxy we live in. It's got to be the right kind of galaxy, folks. Did you know that? Not just any galaxy will do. So what I've designed, I've got a picture for you. And you getting ready? Don't do anything yet till I tell you. Thank you. Class, look up here. If we took one grain of sand in my fingers here, I don't know if I could hold one grain of sand. Picked one grain of sand and hold it out like this and look up into the sky. The amount of the sky that would be covered by that one grain of sand is what we're going to be looking at next. Did you get that? We're only looking at one teeny-nicey little bit of this whole universe. It's how much would be subtended by the view of one little piece of sand blocking my vision. So I'm about to show you a picture of that. Happens to be in one place in the universe where the brand new James Webb telescope that was launched into the atmosphere of the Earth and above the atmosphere last summer, right? This is the first picture displayed to humans on Earth by President Biden last summer. Okay? I've ordered the lights off. No going to sleep. Because I want you to get out of the city and look at this as if you were out in the countryside. You ready? Lights off. Ooh, that's pretty good. Now, if I can do this without messing up. You see that glob right there, and that glob, and that glob, and that glob, and that glob? Remember, I told you this is one grain of sand subtending that piece of the universe. You say, isn't that an amazingly big star? Look at that star, look at that star. Folks, those are not stars, those are galaxies that each have a billion or more stars in the galaxy. I want you to be overwhelmed. So that's an elliptical galaxy that probably has 3 billion stars in it at least. Most of the galaxies you see up here are either elliptical or they are irregular. But every once in a while you get one like that. Can you see that one very well? See how it got spirals on it? Do you see another one of those in this whole picture? I don't. And the reason, class, is there's almost no galaxies that are spiral like that. Let's get the lights back on. This is the galaxy cluster SMAX 0723 from the James Webb Space Telescope, July the 12th, 2022. It saw things we've never seen before. And all you see is more and more and more. But folks, only certain ones of those galaxies could support a solar system like ours in which there's life on this planet. And that's a fact. And we happen to live in a spiral galaxy. We call it the Milky Way. Only about 5% of all the galaxies in the universe are spirals. But by the way, it's not just any old spiral. It has to be a tightly wound spiral, of which there's about 1%. So class, about 99% of the galaxies in the universe could not support a solar system with a planet around it with life on it like we have here. That's kind of narrowing the odds down, isn't it? But it's not just being in the right galaxy. You've got to be at the right place in the galaxy. So here's our Milky Way galaxy looked at from the side. Do you see that big blob in the middle? That's a whole bunch of stars. And if our solar system were in here, it would last a few microseconds. There's too much electrical and gravitational force going on in there. No, everybody knows that it can only survive
in these two blobs right out here on the edges, and guess where our sun and its solar system falls? In one of those. And isn't that a good coincidence? What a coincidence. That our living system is in the exact right place it needs to be in a small number of types of galaxies. So my question to you, class, is, as a jury, how many coincidences do you have to have before you say, somebody tampered with that? Are you following my argument? This is the fine-tuning argument. But you got to have the right kind of star. It's not good enough just to be in the right place in the galaxy. You got to be the right kind of star. Well, there's our sun, kind of in a comparative. The sun's a lot bigger than the planets, you'd agree, wouldn't you? But did you know the sun is not very big compared to Sirius and Pollux and Arcturus? There's the sun right there. And I'm not finished. Because there are stars a whole lot bigger than that. Here's Betelgeuse and Antares. And where in the world is the sun? It's right there. Can't you see it? You know, class, our sun, there's a bunch of stars smaller than it. They're called dwarf stars. And there's a bunch of stars way bigger. And guess what our sun is? Just right. I almost wish you could say that, couldn't you? You say it in your mind. Our sun is just right. Not only in size, but in temperature and the maintenance of its gravitational pull. You got to have the right kind of star. That means, class, most stars are eliminated for supporting a system with life on it like ours. That's like his turning on the gas 2 days before they were dead. Somebody tampered with this. But then you got to be on the right planet. Even if you get all that right, you got to be on the right planet. Well, here are our planets. Folks, do you think there could be life on Jupiter? If you do, may I examine your head? It couldn't last there for 2 microseconds. And Saturn's the same way, and Uranus and Neptune. Earth is at the right size and on the right place around the sun. It's called the habitable zone. And everybody knows it. So, how about others? Well, you know what that one is? That's Venus, almost the same size as us. It's in the habitable zone, and so is Mars right here. Mercury's too close, and Pluto, some of it's a little different being a planet. I don't know what you think about that, but I think Pluto's back. Did you know our space program, NASA, sent up a mission to Pluto from 2006 to 2016? Took it 10 years to get there. Yeah, Pluto's back. But that's not the discussion. There's no life on Pluto. How about Venus? Well, if it's almost 90% sulfuric acid in its atmosphere, that's not a good place for living things. So nobody's looking for life on Venus. Besides that, it twists backwards. It rotates backwards. It's a weird planet. So it's not even considered. But they are looking on Mars, aren't they? Everybody is, because it's the closest thing we've got to something that might have had some hint of some possibility of some maybe. And our Earth is overrun. Now you've got to be on the right planet, at the right place. That's 2 more coincidences. That's not all. You've got to have the proper mass, spin, tilt, moon, atmosphere, crust, etc. And you got to have the properties of biochemicals, cells, genetic code, molecular machines. Folks, I haven't touched the hem of the garment of everything that has to be fine-tuned or you wouldn't be here. Any one of them turned even the smallest amount, you wouldn't be here. No wonder Meyer says we need to re-examine the design argument. And there's the cell, which in Darwin's day, one scientist says it's a little glob of albuminous carbon. That's all they knew about cells.
class. You've studied this enough. Cells are incredibly complex things with all kinds of things going on in there every microsecond of every day. And what we've learned, folks, is to look at things way down here. A nanometer is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. Eyes up here. If this is a meter, divide this into 1 billion equal parts. And one of those parts is the level we can now talk about in cells. We know what's going on down in there. And you know what it is? It's a lot. So here's some things that are different sizes. There's frog eggs, about 1 millimeter. Here's a biological cell. It's 10 to 100 micrometers. But we're talking down here in nanometers. You can't use optical microscopes or even electron microscopes very far down here, but X-ray crystallography. We're talking nanometers. That's where chemistry lives. And what I'm telling you, class, is down there at that level, there are machines doing stuff all the time. We knew nothing about those machines 30 years ago. And there are thousands of them doing amazing jobs. I'll talk about this a little more tomorrow. Kinesin is a little guy that moves stuff. You want a mover? Hire Kinesin. He's a protein that moves stuff. He also helps with cell division. So do dynes. They help things beat in the wind. You know little hairs that do this? Dynes help that happen. They also help with cell division. And that's what I want to talk to you about for just a little bit. Because here's a picture of a Kinesin walker. This is the Kinesin walker. And this is another one, walking on a microtubule here, and look at what they're carrying. I mean, that thing is probably 10,000 times as big as he is, and he's lugging it along. Lots of stuff in your cells has got to be carried from here to there. And we'll hire a Kinesin walker. They're little proteins that do amazing jobs. They're better than anything man ever built. And they're working right now. You know why you get tired just sitting there listening to me? You got proteins working their hearts out, doing all kinds of stuff. And here's a guy that knows how to make it come alive. This is Drew Berry, biomedical animator. You can't see down at that level, so what he does, make it come alive with a cartoon. So I'm borrowing from Drew Berry. And here's the next thing. Before you start it, I'm getting hot up here. I'm going to take my coat off. No, I'm not, because it's got the microphones in it. You're going to stand up for just a minute, because I'm losing you. Stand up, everybody. No fair leaving. I need you for about another 10 minutes. Okay? If I were sitting down, we had a nice supper, I would be falling asleep too, so I'm not blaming anybody. Have a seat. Thank you for being cooperative. All right, what you're about to watch, class, is mitosis. One cell becomes two, and the two that it becomes are exactly like the one you started with. This ought to have at least a month's worth of lectures. I'm going to show you a live picture because you can see this cell with an optical microscope. So this is a live picture of a cell dividing. Then I'm going to show you what happens down inside that we've learned about. Somebody's been tampering with this. This didn't just happen by natural causes. Darwinianism is a joke when it comes to explaining this kind of complexity. No way. All right, let's go. You ready to stop and start when I tell you? Who's doing it? Jonathan. Jonathan, don't you mess me up. All right. All right, here we go. Watch the live cell. You need me to click it first? Okay. Here we go. All right, here's the cell with all its protoplasm inside. And of course, what you're especially looking at is the nucleus, which has all the DNA in it, most all of it. And you can see it's starting to divide up. And then it starts pulling apart until from one cell you get two cells. Stop right there. Folks, I wish I could explain to you how the DNA is copied. There are billions of base pairs in there. Everyone has to be copied exactly right. And then it splits apart. That is such an amazing process. We ought to be on our knees saying, "Dear God, how did you do this?" And instead, men are bragging on how much they've learned. That process should take us a long time to explain. But just understand, it's remarkable because now you've got two where you had one. Did you know that's where you came from? Inside your mama's womb? You came from one fertilized egg. You know how many cells are in your body? 37 trillion! That means they all divided and copied themselves with almost perfect precision. Let's go back now. Let's start again. I mean, all you have to do is click it and go forward, because it's going to blank out and we're going to go back. And now I want you to look down deep inside. So watch. We're going to focus in on one particular chromosome out of all of these. This is the guy we're going to look at, the metaphase chromosome. Stop right there. Can you? Yeah, good. Yeah, go a little bit further if you would. Yeah, stop. Two copies of your DNA. You see right here, this is one copy and behind it is the other one. Can you see that? It's a precise copy of the same thing, but they're still together. They got to be pulled apart. So I want to show you how that happens. Go. So now we're going to focus in on this part of that particular whole glob of stuff called the kinetic core right here. That's where the action takes place. Kinetic means action. The kinetic core is right here, and you see all these things coming out? Those are called microtubules. Stop right there for just a moment. This is a giant molecular machine that controls chromosome movement. And these microtubules have to be built, class. They don't just exist. That system builds the microtubules that help pull it apart. And by the way, it's built starting here in the kinetic core, and it goes out in both directions. But out here on the other end, way out here where the job is finished, they're tearing down the thing as fast as they build it. Like any good government, right? But the problem in a cell is if you let those microtubules keep being built and don't tear them down, you're going to have a globbed up cell that can't do anything. So they tear them down and recycle it. Looks like a plan to me, class. But the fact is, if microtubules are built, and they're all going to show you what happens. Go. So we're going to focus in now on this, where the action is. And you know this is an animation. You can't see all this stuff up close. But this is what's going on in the kinetic core. See all this red area? Stop right there for just a second. There's all kinds of activity going on here. Class, there's over 200 different proteins doing different jobs, all in microseconds. And one of those jobs is to build this highway. Bunch of highways coming out of here. The microtubules are being built by the proteins up here. And then when the timing is right, and by the way, did you know that the DNA is so established that it can time things so they happen just when they should? That would be another day's lesson, class, to explain to you the chemistry of timing, which I'm just sloughing on. Keep going. You see all these little things going on in here? Activity by crazy. There's lots of proteins doing their jobs. And the way this animator has set it up, this red is going to eventually turn green, because green means go. But it does not turn green, class. That's the animator. But you watch. It starts turning green. See it? Now stop right there. All right, what's happening is these proteins are saying the time is right for the division to begin to take place, and so you start sending proteins down the microtubules, those walkers I was telling you about. We're going to watch them now for a little bit. Keep going. Can you see these proteins starting to take a walk? Here we go. And by the way, they're carrying something red with them. You see this? There's your dynein walkers going this direction, all the way down those microtubules. And in the other direction, see these little guys? This is your kinesin walkers going the other way. Stop right there for just a second. Kinesin walkers generally go this way, and dynein walkers go this way. And they each have their specific job, and they're doing this so fast you can't even see it. And the end result is things pull apart. Keep going. By the way, you see these blue guys here? That's another protein. Very important because it's keeping the microtubules in place and moving along with it. All right, now we're going back out to the large scene. You see what's happening? The time is right. And now these microtubules are pulling in this direction. These are pulling in this direction. And they've decided it's time to break. And so you get the two pieces of chromosome that are identical copies separating and going to the opposite poles, just like you saw in the big picture here, only we were looking at just that one, but there's all of them happening at the same time, and you end up with, class, two complete cells that are exact copies of the first one. And now you have a little more appreciation of what's going on inside your cells. Do you know how many mitoses take place in your cell daily? Okay, that's homework. No fair looking right now, because you're listening to me. I want to know how many of you found out cell divisions take place in your body in one day. You got it? That's your assignment. It's a lot. I think we're through, aren't we? Isn't that the end of that one, John? Can I go forward? Well, there we go. I have one more thing to do with you tonight, and that's introduce you to this gentleman. His name is Dr. James Tour. You can see what it says. He's professor of chemistry, material science, and nanoengineering at Rice. That means he does engineering at the 1/1,000,000th of a meter level. And he's doing amazing things, class. If I had time to tell you, I could tell you some of the medical stuff he's into. This guy's got enough copyrights already to be a billionaire, I think. He's not, but he's doing a lot of creative stuff with his team at Rice. He has used graphene, which is a layer of carbon, one atom thick. And one of the things they've experimented on is cutting the neck of a rat. I'm all for that. Sorry. But using graphene, they've been able to restore the rat's ability to function after they cut its cord. Incredible. So he's doing amazing things. But he and his team decided, among other things, if we're going to work at the nano level, we ought to build a nano car. Of course. So he's done exactly that. And there's a bunch of folks around the world trying to do the same thing. And of course, once you build a car, what do you have to do? Have a car race, of course. So he's built this nano car. Look at the different parts to it. See, there's that's the mechanism that makes it move. Here's the axles, and here are the wheels. Folks, that is all one molecule that they built at the nano level. And it moves around. You have to either activate it by chemicals or by light. And it moves. And it makes this little guy turn, which makes it move forward. And you see it over here? You got to have a suspension system, a rolling motion. You got to have affinity. You got to have motion. Well, they've done it. And so they took this little guy and they entered him into a race.
April the 28th and 29th, 2017, in Toulouse, France, the first ever nano car race. You can't even see it, class, because it's at the nano level, but you can race cars. You believe me? They have to have special ways of observing it. So we had a team from Austria and the U.S. That's where Rice University's team was. You see right here? France, Germany, Japan, Switzerland, and another U.S. university entered this race. And here was the results. Drum roll, please. Thank you. Ta-da! Austria, the U.S. team won. They went 150 nanometers in 1.5 hours. That's 151 billionth of a meter. That's really whipping along there. But the other team, Switzerland, came in second at 133 nanometers in 6.5 hours. And the rest of them gave up. This is not an easy thing. But Dr. Tour has become a world famous person because of his nano engineering. He's incredible. But may I tell you, he's a messianic Jew who believes in Jesus Christ, that he was raised from the dead. You go look at his website. He will tell you, you want to become a Christian, you learn about the resurrection. And he said, there's absolute evidence that he was raised from the dead. And you need to know that if you're not a Christian. I love that. One of the famous, world-renowned nano engineers. So just one little piece of information for you. The first round of nano cars was this one. It went 1.8 revolutions per hour, and it got nowhere. The second generation went 3 million revolutions per second, and they did it by changing this rotor right here. I want you to look at this rotor and this rotor and see if you can tell the one difference. Can you see it? Forget the colors. They don't mean anything. See that? That's a hexahedron right there with a sulfur in it. Over here, it's a pentagon, or pentahedron, without the sulfur. That is the only difference. And this one goes 3 million revolutions per second. That one goes 1.8 revolutions per hour. He won the race with this one. But class, and you get this. How did he and his team get such an amazing car? Here's what he says. The nano cars built by Rice team were much smaller and far less complex than the Kinesin Walker and Dynein Walkers and any other molecular machine. He says, the cars I built are nothing compared to what your cells do all the time. Rice team's been working on nano cars for over 20 years. Every molecular machine in living cells is much larger, at least 10,000 times large, much more complex, and much more sophisticated than they've been able to do in 20 years. Here's a taste of how much work and intelligence it took to produce this nano car. All right, is everybody's eyes up here? I want nobody sleeping. Here's one page that describes how they made it. I'll give you a few minutes to read it. And here's page two. And folks, we haven't begun, because after he won that race, everybody in the race said, can you help us learn how to make better nanocars? He said, I've already written the article. And he published it just a few days after that race. And here it is in the magazine Tetrahedron. And the date was May the 17th, 2017. You see, that race was in April, remember? There are 281 pages of supplemental characterization data like the two pages I just showed you. To get this little guy to run around on gold foil for 150 nanometers in an hour and a half, which is nothing. That's how much intelligence it took just to get that.
I would say we know very well nano cars were designed by intelligent human engineers. Wouldn't you agree? That didn't just come about. It took terribly hard work over years of time. So would it not be reasonable to say that living cells that contain thousands of nanomachines, much more complicated, interdependent, and full of digital information, surely were designed by God? And ladies and gentlemen, if that doesn't convince you, I don't know how I can help you. At the nano level, there are things more complex than anything man ever invented in all the history of mankind. And tomorrow, I want to tell you more, because we have not begun. It is no wonder that philosopher, atheist, author, and debater Anthony Flew, at the age of 80, wrote a book called There Is No, I Mean, A God. And the subtitle is How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. I appreciate a man at 80 changing his mind about something as significant as whether there's a God or not. And he did. And here's one quote from him that I love. It has become inordinately difficult even to begin to think about constructing a naturalistic theory of the evolution that first produced, that first reproducing organism. The enormous complexity by which the results were achieved looks to me like the work of intelligence. It now seems to me that the findings of more than 50 years of DNA research have provided materials for a new and enormously powerful argument to design. And I say, amen. It's as if God has thrown the floodgates open. What are you going to do with this? And you know what Dawkins and others of his are doing with it? They're saying it looks like it's designed, but it wasn't. Natural selection and the blind forces of physics did it all. And I say, if you have that much faith, I've got a bridge I want to sell you. So is it reasonable to believe in God in this scientific age? I say Christianity and science say the same thing. You look at things that are designed and you can become convinced somebody designed that. And you can convict jury without anybody ever having seen God. So Christianity and science agree. It's more reasonable than it's ever been to believe there's a God behind this. And boy, were you a good audience. And I'm done. You lasted an hour and a half. That's pretty good. But thank you, because I hope you see why I'm so excited about all this. And please come back tomorrow. We're done for tonight. Except for the Q&A, I guess. So, you're going to take over?
At this point, we're going to...